filters are kind of even more relevant than ever, and the personal touch in filtering. Algorithms look at BPM and people who searched for also liked, whereas I'm searching for something like a feeling in music.
Das ist der Telekom Electronic Beats Podcast, der Podcast rund um Nachtleben und Clubkultur.
Wir sprechen mit DJs, Türstehern, Tänzern, Clubbetreibern und anderen Nachtmenschen.
Mein Name ist Gesine Kühne.
Und ich bin Jakob Töne.
Herzlich willkommen beim Electronic Beats Podcast.
Hello again, it's me, Jakob Töne, and welcome to the Telekom Electronic Beats podcast. As you can hear, we're talking in English this episode, as I met one of London's most wanted music selector, DJ, and promoter. I'm talking about Benji B. Besides his regular radio show on BBC Radio 1, he runs the event series and label Deviation and was working as a musical director for several fashion brands like Celine or Louis Vuitton. Benji told me how he gained his knowledge in music and where his passion for dance culture comes from. We also talked about the relevance of radio stations nowadays and about his way to work with different creatives of different disciplines such as Kanye West or Virgil Abloh. As some people may think now, A, did he travel to London these weeks during lockdown? Of course not. We already recorded this episode back in September when I was still able to visit Benji in London. Also, he gave me a preview of his compilation, which was supposed to come out now, but unfortunately he had to push the release to early 2021. Nevertheless, I'm also very happy that we got our hands on this to give you a little sneak peek. Hey Benji, and welcome to the podcast, Benji B.
How you doing? Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. I'm enjoying the sunny London.
Welcome to London.
Thank you. Benji, you're a music producer, but you also produce radio shows. You're a very known, international known DJ touring the world, and you're also producing and curating music for fashion shows. What do all these things have in common for you, and why, like, how did they work side by side?
To me, they're all the same thing. They're different expressions of the same thing. And that thing is music frequency. They're basically different attention points along that spectrum, but they're connected by the same thing, the same force. And the main thing that changes with all of those things is context. Context is the thing that changes how you approach them. But it's often a very similar core skill set and passion that's required for all of them, which is, you know, a deep love and understanding and care about music, really. So it's funny, I never really think of it in that way until you list all of those things, because often when you're going at 100 miles an hour and you're just doing them, you don't think about all these different like areas, disciplines, whatever you want to call it. But it is true, I do all of those things. But to me, they're all interconnected.
The deep love or the passion for music maybe also comes from your parents. I mean, your father had a great record collection and he was also very much into music. Do you remember your first memory of music, or how did you get in touch with music?
Since zero, music's been on constantly around. I've been surrounded by creative people and a musical world. And as you correctly said, also was lucky enough to grow up with an incredible record collection that was outside of the norm, let's say. And, you know, both my mom and dad, very, very, very instrumental in encouraging me to find my own musical identity and explore it. And I think that that's probably something I'm the most grateful for, is that, you know, I often hear stories about people saying, oh, you know, I wanted to do music, but, you know, it wasn't encouraged. Well, in my case, it was the opposite. You know, any musical interest that I showed, whether it was wanting to take up an instrument or do this, that, you know, was always fully backed and fully encouraged. And that's the biggest gift you can give anyone.
Was there a key moment that you can remember where you start digging more records and were more into playing records instead of like participating as a musician?
Yeah, I think, you know, I was musician from sort of like 6, 7 years old until about 20. And I think that in my sort of mid-teens, DJing took over as a more immediate way to express myself, because at that era, in that time, it wasn't like now where all you need is a laptop. You know, you kind of needed a studio back then. You know what I mean? To make electronic music or to make beats or to make the kind of stuff that I was into at the time.
You started playing saxophone.
Yeah, I did.
I mean, that's more difficult to record.
You know all this stuff. It's amazing. I did play saxophone from age 7, and that's a really good example of what you're saying is, you know, getting to a certain age where someone says, you know, or more specifically, my dad would say, well, what instrument do you want to play? And I'd say sax, and then off we go, and we're working out how to make that happen.
I think most of the people were told, like, play the piano or don't play the drums or not the saxophone, because that
Well, I wish I had
noisy.
Played the piano, to be honest, because if I could go back now and choose, I would probably do it all over the same again, but I'd also learn piano or guitar, because piano and guitar are kind of like the keys to the musical universe, you know, in terms of understanding harmony, in terms of understanding composition. Thing about performance instruments like, you know, well, any melody instrument like the sax, trumpet, you know, whatever, those fundamentally come down to being very, very, very good at performing, like being very disciplined about doing your scales, very disciplined about performing. And obviously you can compose, and that goes without saying, but I think that you also have to be very, very high level to take that to a next level. Whereas if you learn piano or guitar, you can use that as a tool to be a composer. You don't necessarily have to be a virtuoso pianist.
Yeah, you can't play chords with a saxophone.
Nah, unfortunately you can't, no. But yeah, I did grow up playing music, and then the bit where music DJing took over was I sort of fell in love with records, really. Like I was always obsessed with records. I was always trying to mix records into the radio, mix records into a tape, you know, even before I knew what I was doing. And I became very obsessed with buying records and vinyl culture and all the rest of it, but really weirdly young, like 10, 11, 12, you know.
Well, yeah, that's
and,
young.
And then by the age of 14, I was fully gone into DJing, you know, pirate radio, studying clubs before I was even old enough to go to clubs, you know. And I think that DJing and mixing together records and the culture of DJing was super creative at that time, and still is, of course. But was kind of unusual. It wasn't usual. It wasn't like everyone was a DJ, you know? And so, I got into it heavy around sort of 14, 15, 16 years old, I'd say.
Yeah, I've read you entered the clubs with the age of 15.
Yeah. I started going super young, it's true.
In the clubs, I mean, when you're 15, like everybody's older than you. Maybe there's a similarity to when you went on tour with your with the parents, well, what you told earlier, that like when you're surrounded by creatives, you get used to it as a child. And then when you enter the club, I also heard or read that you went there alone.
Oh, I went to clubs all the time on my own, yeah. Because when I was at school and I was that age, there was no one that really kind of on the same wavelength musically, really, or was able to do that. But I went a lot alone, but in the knowledge that I was going to see people that I knew, because at that time it wasn't like you just buy a ticket for a headline act or something. I wasn't interested in that. I was like interested in residencies. So I'd go to weekly nights where you'd often see the same DJs, the same heads. And then after a while you get to know people and that becomes a family of sorts. Do you know what I mean? And so there were a few club nights that like that, where I had my own family, where I'd just go and my family would be there. You know what I mean? So it wasn't like you didn't feel weird about turning up alone. It was like you knew who was going to be there.
Even if you're early, then the other came, just come.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, that whole period was, yeah, of course, there's social element. There's like saying hello to people, but it was really about music and music discovery.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That was my musical discovery portal, was going to nightclubs. It wasn't really about anything other than that. I was just obsessed with music. And so, you know, I was quite young and quite just had a super open mind, and I'd just soak up the music and then I'd go home. You know what I mean? It was like, it was that simple.
Do you remember the first night when you entered a club? Because I remembered my first time at a club and it was so impressive that I kind of got stuck into until today.
I don't know. I don't know, remember which one it was. I mean, I think the ones that I went to first were not the cool ones, because the ones that I remember, we went to Hammersmith Palais once because it was like an under, or you could get in easily, or it was an under 18s night or something like that. But that wasn't cool. That was like a bit cheesy, you know. And then we went to a couple of cheesy nights at the Camden Palace, which is now called Coco. But, you know, it, that wasn't, so I think the first nights that I went to were probably just like, you know.
Keep it secret.
No, I think they were just like, they probably had like Baby D performing or like something like that. You know what I mean? It was like, or it was rave stuff probably, which were cool, but they weren't like serious nightclubs, you know?
Yeah.
And then I went to the Dome, I think, in Tufnell Park, which was kind of easy to get into. I think there were a few places like that, but, no, the honest truth is I can't remember what the first one was.
But can you remember the first radio show you were working on?
Oh, yeah, of course. The first radio show that I worked on was with Giles Peterson at Kiss FM. And
how did you meet each other? I mean,
I met him at one of those club nights. I met him at That's How It Is, which was his club night at Bar Rumba on Shaftesbury Avenue on a Monday night. And I used to go there every Monday.
So you were a resident somehow.
I was a resident, yeah. Resident on the dance floor, yeah. And I met him there when I was 16 years old. And I started working on his show at Kiss while I was still doing my A-levels, which is in the UK, you know, between 16 and 18.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was my first experience of a radio studio, and I've been in one since every week for the rest of my life.
Why is radio still so much important to you or in general?
It's a really big question, that one. I think it's important to me because it's a format that has meant so much to me for my whole life. And therefore, at this point, it's kind of in my DNA. You know, it's in my routine. It's in my understanding. It's in my, like, doing a 2-hour radio show once a week of new music put together in a way. There's obviously lots of different interpretations of radio. Like if you go to America, radio means something different, unless you're talking about college stations or NPR or something like that, you know. And certainly some people that think of the radio think about what you turn on at 3 p.m. when you get in your car, you know. And then in this life that I've had, I'm lucky enough to have been most influenced by specialist radio, which when I was a kid was the internet, you know. That was my internet. That was my
source of,
yeah, that was my SoundCloud, that was my Mixcloud, that was my whatever, Discogs, that was my, you know, the radio was like, unless there was two places to discover music, you know, the clubland and the radio, going to nightclubs and going to the radio. Those are the two places where you're going to hear new music. And obviously, even when the internet arrived, which became more common sort of like late 90s, it was still the source. You know, because it's the format that had the most influence on me. It just always did, man. It was just like such a special thing to sit down for 2 hours, you know, and hear your favorite DJs. And I was very lucky to come up in a time when there were some amazing DJs around. And so it was like a religion for me. And it was also like, you know how some people have weekly appointments with their favorite TV soap or TV show or whatever.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, oh, it's 7 p.m. on a Wednesday. I've got to watch EastEnders or whatever it is. My thing was like, oh, it's 7 p.m. on a Wednesday. I've got to listen to Jumpin' Jack Frost on Kiss FM, you know, or I've got to listen to Randall, or I've got to listen to Fabian Grooverider or Giles or Colin Dale or, you know, Max.
So you had fixed appointments.
I had fixed appointments with these people.
Yeah.
And this was before you could listen on demand and listen again. So I'd tape them. If I couldn't listen, I'd tape it. And sometimes I'd tape it anyway and then listen to it throughout the week. So it's like an art form that I studied, really. And it's still relevant to me today because there's no algorithm, there's no experience that can put together music in that way for 2 hours and present it and explain what it is and draw this sketchbook over 2 hours of presenting new music and being a filter for new music. And so I think in a way, the answer to your second question of like, why is it still relevant is because, you know, filters are more important than ever now, you know, in a world where we have just an abundance of amazing choice, you know, filters are kind of even more relevant than ever. And the personal touch in filtering. Yeah, of course, an algorithm can say that because you like this one song by Carl Craig, you might well like this song by Moritz von Oswald or whatever. Like, you know, sure. And that's getting more and more sophisticated all the time. But in terms of a DJ mix, you know, putting together, I mean, I'm sure that we will be replaced by algorithms in about 20 years.
Oh, you think so?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, if Spotify can correctly guess your music taste as a playlist, you know, and you've got people using auto sync and mixing together. I mean, who knows where it's going, but it doesn't matter. Point is that radio is the one thing that's exempt from that because it's about personality and it's about personal taste. It's about
personal
touch. Yeah. And it's also about connection with people. You know, I remember sometimes listening to great broadcasters like John Peel or, you know, people of that kind of stature who I'd probably put like David Attenborough or people like that, you know, in that category, who make you feel like they're just broadcasting to you. You know, even if you're driving on the motorway, it makes you feel like the radio show is just for you.
Like they're sitting in your ear and showing you new music.
And so for that reason, it's always been my portal. It's been my vehicle. It's been the way that I express myself. And that comes around really fast once a week, you know, when you have to come up with 2 hours of new music. And I think that the reason it's relevant to me is because it sharpens the diamond for me.
Yeah.
I can't ever become one of those guys that, you know, oh yeah, I'll go record shopping in a couple of months and see what's out there. It's like I have to do that search every single week.
So you have the approach that you're showing week by week every time new music?
Oh man, absolutely. Like, but to a point where it's probably 95% new music. Like I repeat myself very rarely. So the flow is constant.
Yeah.
I think it's probably one of the most high turnovers of new music of any weekly radio show. It must be because, you know, we spend at least two days a week on it, you know, at least finding
new music.
Well,
that's a lot for 2 hours of...
Yeah. That's how long it takes. It's 2 days for 2 hours, really. You know, because you're searching, you know, all the promos. You're listening to all your promos. Then you're searching what's in the record shops. Then you're searching what's on the sort of, I don't know, sites, blogs, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And then obviously what you have physically in your record collection. I mean, it's like it's a lot that goes into making that selection. So... Yeah, I told you it was a big question. But it's still an art form that I care about. I can understand, conversely, I can totally understand why some people are like, radio, that's a bit out of date now. You know, I can understand why they would say that.
Yeah, but
for me, it's not.
I really get the personal touch. Like when you're referring, I think it's also the same. Or I think you've said it, that the radio show is also the mixtape. Like when you're
That's how I approach it every week.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was to do a randomized mix show where I was basically going, okay, there's 25 songs that I like, bang them in a playlist.
Yeah.
That would take me half as long. It's about presenting it in a way that means something. My job has always as well been to link people's taste because not everyone that loves house music loves hip hop and not everyone that loves hip hop loves jazz, you know. And so it's about taking people there in a way that makes sense, you know?
Also getting people to stay on the show to maybe show some new aspects of music or like somebody who's more into grime or hip hop is you can catch them with two songs and then you sneak in a dance track and they're like, okay, wow. I wouldn't click and play on Spotify or the Spotify algorithm wouldn't surprise me.
Exactly.
But now I got this wow moment.
Exactly, because algorithms look at BPM and people who searched for also liked, you know, whereas I'm searching for something like a feeling in music, like a certain soul in records that, you know, means something to me. So,
yeah.
But I'm always, you know, radio is also about the now. Of course we can, like anyone, I enjoy digging in my own crates and playing some old stuff, but my show is really about reflecting the now, reflecting what I have been doing also on the weekend when we used to be able to go to clubs. So it's finding that balance between listening music and club music, you know, because obviously if you hear me playing a club, I'm not going to play ambient music and jazz, you know. But why would I have a radio show where I can't express music to listen to as well as to dance to? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So you can like show more your broader taste instead of in a club where also the function plays a big role. Like,
yeah.
And if you're playing an ambient track after the dance track, people might stop dancing and maybe the vibe is going down.
Well, I think that's why. I mean, I can really understand why people get confused as to what I do musically sometimes in terms of the new audience. The people who know what I do never seem to have any confusion. They know that when they go out, they're going to hear me playing.
They expect surprises.
Dance music.
Yeah.
Very varied, but dance floor, tempo, music or whatever. And that on the radio, they're going to hear the breadth of my taste, like the diverse taste that I have. But I think that new promoters in dance music sometimes might listen to my show and go, oh,
I don't get it.
I don't really understand what he does. Like,
that doesn't work on the dance floor.
Yeah. Why are we going to book this guy? He's playing like hip hop and jazz or something. You know, it's like, and I understand that confusion, but traditionally that's always been my balance, you know. DJing, I'm from a dance music club background, you know what I mean? So, but I'm also from a hip hop background, you know what I mean?
You also started a party series in 2007 called Deviation. Mm-hmm. And I've also read that you wanted to create a party where also DJ can play what they want to play and not to serve a certain expectation.
Yeah.
You started also on Wednesdays in London.
Yeah.
And also in a space where you wanted to be the only event that they, like the people have to really go there and on purpose, they don't fall into the door and like say, okay, let's see what's happening here.
Yeah.
Why did you choose that approach?
Because I found that always separates the people that are there by accident to the people that really want to be there. With clubs, I've always wanted to have, I'd much rather have 50 people that are passionate about being there for the right reasons than 500 that don't know where they are, you know.
I can really understand that.
And so for me, it goes back to your first question. It was all about what I grew up with, which was going out on a Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, Friday. Like, sounds crazy now because, you know, it happens less, but that was really the professional nights to go out, you know. Saturday, difficult, you know, because
lots of tourists, lots of people from outside.
The weekday nights were always the music heads.
Yeah.
And so at that time, that's what I wanted to do. It was about sampling the best bits of the clubs that I grew up with as well, whether it be sound system, whether it be what you just mentioned. But yeah, it was for that reason, really, is that I felt like starting it on a Wednesday at a kind of unusual destination meant that it would have to grow organically, even if that meant having it half full, a quarter full on the first one. I'd much rather play that long game of it building in a real way, you know, than to have it packed with a headliner on night number one, because there's no longevity in that, you know. I wanted it to have its own community, have its own regulars, you know. And that's what every great residency should be, really.
I mean, when you look back or when you go through the lineups, then I'd say from today's perspective, there were plenty of headliners playing that show. But a very early stage, like how did you manage to like find the right acts or the ones that really maybe also were innovative for a time? How did you find them back then? Flying Lotus, Floating Points at the very early stage, James Blake hanging around, I read.
The same way I do now. I mean, those people are part of the DNA of what Deviation is, and they're part of the DNA of my radio show. We're all part of each other's development. You know, it's a symbiotic sort of thing. You know, we, Flying Lotus, as an example, seeing it's the first name you mentioned, you know, was sending me CDRs, beat demos before Warp, you know, before records were released or whatever. I just play them on my show. I just have always had a direct relationship with artists. To me, it's not about ever who's going to be hot, who's going to blow up, you know, what's cool, anything like that. It's just a direct love relationship with music. And if it's something that I believe in, then I'll play it heavily. And at that time, you know, that was what was going on. Same thing with Sam Floating Points. You know, he approached me in at the club actually and gave me a CDR. I remember it said myspace.com/floating point
nice.
In like handwriting. And I was like, oh, right. And that just was in my pile of listening. And I listened to it and it had Love Me Like This on it. And I was like, what the hell is this? And it was only a minute long. And then we used to loop it up on the CDJ and play it at the night. And there's a lot of records that have their own story at the night. And yes, the fact that there were a lot of musicians and DJs coming down when they weren't playing is the biggest compliment you can get.
Yeah.
It was a heads night, you know, and you'd look out and there'd be DJs, musicians, rappers, you know, producers, whatever.
Like a DJ's night out.
Kind of, yeah. But in a really organic, natural way. It's not something you can ever cook up on purpose, that kind of thing. It just has to happen naturally. But in terms of answering your question, I was just booking the people I was playing on the radio. You know, I wasn't booking people going, oh, wow, this person's going to be big, inverted commas. And a lot of them were successful already. It's just that in our grassroots music community, there's always been a sort of a network of understanding that, and it's the same now. You know, if Code 9 phones me up now and says, can you play at my night? I'm not saying, yeah, but how much have you got? You know, if Kenny Dope phones me and asks me to play, or anyone that I respect in music, I could give you any number of names that have had that longevity of relationship with me. It's not the same thing as when a promoter calls you up and says, do you want to play in such and such town on New Year's Eve or whatever? It's just a different thing. And that is the thing that's always, that's the roots of scenes of music,
yeah,
of genres. That's basically how it's always worked. You know what I mean? When I used to get booked at Plastic People, it wasn't like I'd like cancel other things in order to do it. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, the sort of grassroots thing of doing what's at the core of what you're about is more important to me than anything else. So of course, as DJs, we go and get paid by doing other things. But really, it's those nights that are the genesis of all the best moments. And so there's a kind of interconnected relationship amongst artists. So even the ones that you perceive as big at the time or not or whatever, you know, it was about really my relationship with those people and the ability to book them. It wasn't like I was forcing them or pressuring them to do it.
Sounds
it
a bit like the time when you were 14, 15 and entering the club scene and had the feeling that like you were entering a family.
Yeah, well, it is music. The music scene, when it's at its best, is a family of people. And there's a mutual respect that I have with producers and DJs across so many scenes and generations. I'm very lucky, you know, and that's because, you know, for those of us that make this our life, we can smell out pretty fast when it's people that...
When there's a boomer.
When there's a hoover.
A hoover.
When people want to just come in and hoover up or have the liberty of saying, selling off culture to the highest bidder or, you know, that kind of thing. I think music is a language that binds a lot of us, and then also so is culture. You know, the culture of the hours, minutes, days, years, months that you put into culture, in our culture, which is club culture and music culture, is not, there's no fast forward for that. That's not the same thing as saying, oh, you have to have been doing it for years to be in it. That's not at all what I'm saying. You can feel that energy from an 18-year-old. You can feel it from a 40-year-old. You can feel it's just an energy thing. It's like people, it basically comes down to authenticity.
Yeah.
And authenticity and craft. And that, the sort of industrialization of the DJ and club world has threatened that at times, because people think, okay, and now I have to do this thing and this scene and this set on there and then boom, 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 and then my career is set. But in actual fact, you know, building up that kind of grassroots relationship with other DJs, even if it's a new scene you're creating yourself,
yeah,
you know what I mean, of playing for each other and different things, it's not, as you can tell, I'm even having trouble even explaining it. You know what I mean? But it's something that you kind of feel.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, you can also already see this or when you're telling that the DJs just came by, stopped by because they were into for example, or just to hang out because they were into the acts you were booking because they were into the music.
Yeah.
And you share the passion for the artist, for example. And then you also have like the passion to share that connects maybe more than the business opportunities you can get. Because we are all, or the artists are all visionary, I would say so.
They are visionary, yeah. And
so, go after a certain vision, and most of the time you match with other visions, you influence each other. And I think that's also a big part in then being part of the community.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, a big part of Deviation was about introducing people to music. And we were, you know, way ahead of our time in terms of, well, to me, it was normal to put, you know, Moody Man with Hudson Mohawk or Kenny Dope with Flying Lotus or Jay David, you know, but that wasn't being done at all at the time. Music was much more separated at that time.
So you got the house on the one side, more beat driven on the other side, IDM.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, and we were celebrating the kind of very fresh music that was happening at the time. In a way, it was a physical manifestation of what I was doing on the radio. It was like a physical experience of the radio show in a way.
Yeah.
In terms of the artists that I was playing, but it was also about introducing people. Like, I remember the biggest compliment to any night is when people go because of the night, not because of the headliner. Of course that helps. Of course people are going to go if there's an artist that they love and they're excited to see.
Yeah.
But the faces that we used to look out on didn't change. You know, it was like there was regulars and then there was newcomers, and it was like London's best kept or worst kept secret. But it was a trust, and the same, and that's the biggest compliment you can pay anyone, because that trust is the trust that I had for the club nights I went to. So if I went to a club night and they put on a certain DJ, you know, I knew that that DJ or that artist would be of interest to me because they were putting them on, you know. And I remember we had so many moments like that. We had moments like when, I remember when Dorian Concept came for the first time. And Dorian Concept is an artist from Vienna, and he was over from Austria, and he turned up, and we had our regulars, and our regulars were quite kind of hardcore music heads, you know, dancers as well.
Yeah.
You know, like proper, like serious dance floor kind of pressure. It was quite a high pressure place to play.
Yeah.
You had to bring your A game. And I remember Dorian Concept stepped in, and he had like, at the time, first of all, he looked like a kid. He looked like a child because he looks like this innocent child. And he had...
But he's a genius.
Yeah, and he had this like bowl haircut. You know, like those click-on haircuts, like the old Beatles haircuts, like this kind of like real bowl haircut. And he had like a busted cardboard box with a Korg synth in it. And he just sort of took it out and it had a key missing and he put it on top of the box. And I could remember the crowd looking at me and Jude, kind of looking at us like, who's this? Who's this guy? You know, what, you know? And... if ever there's a chart, if ever there's like proof of never judge a book by its cover, you know, because like he just destroyed it, like destroyed everyone, you know, everyone went crazy. And I remember moments like that being really special. So that's a good example of, at the time, people didn't know, believe it or not, when Hudson Mohawk played at the club for the first time, I'd say maybe 25 people there knew, you know, who he was. And same thing when Flylo played the first time, maybe half the club, you know what I mean? A lot of people didn't know. So it's like, it is about introducing things that you believe in as well and standing behind them and not, excuse me, not always relying on book an empty room, book a headliner. How are we going to fill it? Let's make sure we book the most famous person possible.
But I think that's the aim for every promoter who's really into music and really into like creating creative events, that you like your name is getting people along because they knew or they know that when they go there, they will experience nice music and they will listen to great artists. Doesn't matter who's going to play, but they just go there for the music to enjoy. I think that's the main goal. What I mean, when I promoted back in the days, or when I was doing events, that was my main goal because I didn't book any headliner, but it didn't work out apparently. But yeah, I mean, I wish it would have worked out, to be honest. But now, getting a little bit forward to the nowadays situation. I mean, there's no event going on right now because of coronavirus, but you put together a compilation. How difficult was it for you to limit yourself to a certain amount of tracks instead of like having, for example, a 2 hours radio show then released?
I mean, to your point, the club, this compilation is about the era that you're talking about. It was about, I've been wanting to do it for a long time, and that's why it's taken a long time, is because every club night, you know, every club night that's a residency has its own classics. And those classics, some of them might be big tunes outside the club, but some of them really might not be. They might be obscure B-sides or 12 inches that just happen to be successful with your crowd. And then you play them once a month and then they become kind of like a residency staple tune. And that's what this compilation is about. It's about those records.
So some people who were at the parties, they will recognize and then they will have like very big emotions with it.
100%. Yeah, okay. In different ways for different records. It's like often the records are dictated by the people that were at the party. So when I'd play like certain records, depending on the reaction or if it really worked for some reason or if I really believed in a song, I'd keep playing it, you know, month in, month out in my sort of warm-up sets or my opening sets, which were kind of the hardest but also the most enjoyable and most rewarding sets to play, was the set where you're playing from kind of like 9 p.m. when no one's in there all the way through to when the guest plays at midnight or whatever, or 11 or wherever it might have been. In those sets, some classics were born. I'd play at the end of the night as well. And those classics are the ones that I wanted to put on this box set. And of course, I can actually do one better than telling you about it, because you will be the first person to see this, because I just got the finished vinyl.
Oh, really?
So yeah, if you want to have a look at it,
yeah,
this is a world exclusive.
Oh, wow.
I literally just received this. We had it made.
It's a box. Maybe now I need to describe a little bit.
Yeah, it's like I wanted to have it done as a four vinyl box set.
So it's really about it's a collection.
Yeah, it's a collection. Yeah.
Oh, wow. And when you open the box, you see pictures of the parties, I assume.
Yeah,
really great. So you can also, when you're not attend the parties, you can get a vision of what was going on there.
That's a list of everyone that played that we could find, you know.
Yeah.
And
as I said, it's a crazy list. When you nowadays, you see a lot of people who are very like on a high level, not only headliners, but very much like with big releases, interesting releases, nice development.
Yeah. So we did a four vinyl box set because, yeah, I just wanted to make a box set as well that was really about clubbing. This compilation is really about club music. It's not, you know, I've done compilations in the past that are like to whack on in your car or Sundays. And of course you can do that with this as well. But this is really a celebration of music that was big at the club. And the thing about it is that also what I wanted to make was a box set that reminded me of having some of the most useful compilations when I was a teenager. Because when I was a teenager or maybe let's just say a young DJ, and I didn't have much money and whatever.
So you buy compilations where you have a lot of tracks you would play.
Yeah, but they weren't, all DJs would steer away from those compilations that had loads of tracks on one side. There were some DJ compilations like classic master cuts ones or whatever that would be cut like 12 inches. So you'd have maximum two tracks on each side. So they'd be cut really loud, sometimes at 45, and they'd be basically like buying the 12 inch, but you'd get loads in a box set. And sometimes you'd take out one and you'd go and DJ with it. And what I wanted to do was create something like that, that was a time capsule of the classics from that era. And really they're just songs that I chose. So they're songs that as a DJ, in a way that are my classics. And so in a way, this is kind of like a full stop for me. It's like a end of an era. I can kind of now give this sort of time capsule box away, you know, as years of kind of tried and tested songs, because the other criteria were, yeah, it had to be big tunes for us, but some of them are really, really impossible to find on vinyl. Like, for example, that Alice Smith Love Endeavor, which is
A1 track.
Yeah, it's the first tune. Yeah. It had to be the first cut because I think most people that come to the club would associate that song more than many others with like being a deviation anthem. And all of these are anthems in their own way. But like, say, for example, the second track on there is kind of random. It's like, it's just a 12 inch. It's a Gilbert remix of Rick Wilhite from this Detroit Beatdown compilation that I used to play. But we felt like it got played enough for it to make it. Then you got big tunes like Detroit Experiment, Think Twice, and then Tarantula by Zombie. Then you got Carl Craig, Sandstorms, which obviously is a massive tune. Lil Silver, who is kind of like a unofficial resident. And then, as you were saying, you referenced some of the beat era stuff. We've got like that represented, because in 2007, that was definitely a very strong movement that we were representing as well. It wasn't maybe music that we'd play at peak time on the dance floor, but we definitely represent it at some point in the night. Like Hudmo, Fly Low, Double O Genesis, Dorian Concept, as I just mentioned.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was the whole DMZ, you know, Mala, Joy Orbison. We've got Joy Orbison, Hype Mango on here, Mala, Lean Forward.
Like, that's a classic.
Massive tunes. And then Pearson Sound and the Hessel guys and, you know, people that have played a part in the lifespan of the club. And so, you know, for me, I'm very proud of the music that's on here. There's no major label music. There's no big, you know, massive hits or whatever. These are just our hits.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's
Deviation classics.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really happy with it and I'm excited for it to come out. And it has made me feel...
I can tell you're smiling while talking about it.
Yeah, it has made me feel nostalgic because it is quite a while ago now, 2007.
Yeah.
And that period, 2007, for the first 5 years, is probably the main part of this box set. And now when I look back on it, it was a very influential time in music and club culture.
Definitely. Now we're looking at the product, at a record. We were also talking about your work as a radio host, but we didn't talk yet about fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get more into that direction. As you were creating concepts like curation, you were producing also music for runway shows. Or is there a difference between making a record or creation of a record? Of course, I mean, Deviation Classics is a special one, as you connect a lot of emotions, a lot of experiences with it. But how is the process maybe different making a music or a musical piece or a curation for a runway show than maybe for a radio show?
Well, the way you approach music is just about context. So it is always different. The context makes things like wildly different, mostly in terms of length. How things feel and sound changes on the environment and where it's being played. Like if you play, you know, an 8-minute house record in a club, in the right club, in the right setting, it might not feel like 8 minutes at all.
Yeah.
It might feel like just a house record, you know. If you play an 8 minutes house record at a fashion show that where the length of the show is only 12 minutes, it's going to feel like the longest 8 minutes of your life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's going to go on forever and ever and ever. And it's going to feel like you know, context is everything, right? You know, just like we were saying, if you play some kind of experimental, glitchy, underwater ambient track on the radio at 1 a.m. or something, it might sound like the best thing you've ever heard in your life.
Yeah.
You know,
soundtrack of the night drive.
Yeah, exactly. Night drive on the motorway or something. If you play that at 1 a.m. at peak time in a nightclub, people will be like, what are you doing? Context, it sounds like an obvious thing to say, but the reason I'm saying it is because turn that obvious statement up to 11, and that's what defines the difference between the different things you're talking about. And fashion shows and runway shows are all about context, all about environment, all about pace, all about dynamics, and the length and style and everything. All of these minute factors lead into making the perfect runway soundtrack. And it's not something that there's a rule book for. You know, yeah. The first time I ever did it, I just had to do what my interpretation of that was. It's like other people that do the same job will have a different answer for you. But for me, it was just like, that's my understanding of it. You know, I didn't have any training in it or anything. I just had to use it. But everything that you're talking about is basically DJing. Even producing is DJing sometimes.
Like curating of sounds and mixing together sounds that they work well? Or how do you...
100%. 100%. Like DJing is knowing when to play the right thing at the right time and for how long and why. And what to mix it in with and not what not to mix it in with. And why you can play a record and why you can't. And if a record's already rinsed out or if it's not, or can you revisit this one or is this the right time to revive this record? It's like there are hundreds of like small references and things that go into the understanding of placement of music when you're a DJ. And also then let's not forget understanding what club you're at. You know what sure. I mean?
Like I mean the room.
The room you're at, the size that you're at, the crowd that you're at, you know, playing at like Club X is that very different to playing at Club Y, also respecting their local kind of resident DJ and what, you know, there's so many different things to consider as a DJ that almost second nature after you've been doing it for a while. The same is true on the radio and the same is true with applying that skill set to fashion. And if you listen to a lot of the best records that are guided by DJs, they understand, you know, like some of the best records understand have the best middle eight, or they've cut out the cheesy bit, or they know what to take out this 16 bar section, or what's going to work best in this context, because DJs understand that stuff, you know. And so runway is the same context. It's kind of like DJing, but in a much more nuanced way. You know what I mean? It's like understanding how to fit an expression into 9 minutes or 12 minutes or whatever the length of the show is.
I thought there might be a difference because you also have the visual aspects, of course, of a club, as you said, that you also have the room and certain aspects that have influence in your performance. But for the fashion show, for example, there's a concept, like it's not organically somehow, because it's like you're working with also visionary artists, like Virgil Abloh, for example, who has a vision for his fashion and how this could be presented, and you need to somehow adapt or adjust. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the process when you work on that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The visual side is everything. Your job is to, you know, when you're doing music, is to support the visual element, to complement the visual element, to enhance it, to bring it out. The only thing I could really compare it to is music for film.
Score.
Yeah, scoring films or scoring short films, long films, whatever. It's like a similar thing. You're supporting the visual element and adding an emotion to it as well. You know, as we all know from watching movies, like if you heard like a horror soundtrack on top of a romantic scene, it would be funny or it would be wrong.
Or scary.
Or scary.
Yeah.
Or it would change how you feel. Or as you know, like one held note in a song can change what you think is about to happen. You know, if I show you a film of a door from the inside and it's silent, then you think it's a door. Then suddenly you put in some nice music or whatever. You think, oh, you're going to open it out to a sunrise or whatever. And then suddenly you put in like a discordant minor chord and you think someone's going to break through the door with an axe or something. You know, it's like music is very powerful with visual. And the same is true with runway shows, but I think the thing with runway shows is that it's a live experience. Of course, it's now streamed around the world, so it's a visual experience as well, but it's like you're talking about reflecting whatever the core of the collection is that season, whatever the theme is, the environment, the set, the room, capturing the kind of musical mood that you and the creative director and the team are in at that time. And then trying to like tell a story in a very short space amount of time. You know, as I said, time becomes compressed.
Yeah.
Because like 9 to 12 minutes can feel quite long if it's wrong. You know what I mean? But if it's right, then it flows. Sometimes one really interesting kind of like statement piece could be having the same thing going for that long. You know what I mean? If you get it right. Another thing could try and get lots of different expressions, or choosing a texture, choosing a feeling. For me, it's like, it's a very hard thing to put into words, because when I start to talk with a creative director, or I start to talk through ideas, music just starts to appear in my head. You know what I mean? Ideas start to form. And then as soon as I've decided on, well, in the case of what I'm doing at Vuitton, it's slightly different because we work with live music every single time.
Yeah.
And in the other shows that I've done, it's more like me putting a soundtrack together. But in both cases, it's the same. It's like the music starts to form in my head, the curation, the musical direction, the producing of what's going to happen. It kind of just starts to, the records start to pick themselves, you know?
Well, we were talking before the recording, we were also talking about speaking or talking about music, and you described you described the runway shows also with the feelings, with emotions. And I was wondering if it's easy to come along with somebody who's more into visionary aspects in terms of description of the feelings, or is it easy to match? For example, I mean, Virgil, for example, he's very, also very much into music. But is it easy to match on the same level of language when talking about certain emotions and also having like the same opinion about the music then?
With him, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we speak the same language.
So it's easy to work with
him. Oh, man, it's like a blessing. Because when you work with someone that is fluent in the language of music, you know, and also has amazing taste in music and is as passionate about music and the culture of music and the lineage of music and everything that surrounds that as anyone else that you know, it just flows. You know, it's always flowed. You know what I mean? It's a blessing to be able to do it.
Shout out. But was there like a situation or a project where you were working with people where you were sitting there and trying to get what they were saying, but they were basically saying like, I need upbeat and...
Yeah, always, yeah. I've been in that situation a lot. Yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, not everyone can explain, people that work in music, putting it into words, it's a very nuanced set of kind of reference points and context and ideas. So it's sometimes difficult, but I find that when you work with artists in whatever field, whether it be visual arts or clothes or...
I mean, you also work with design. Music artists as...
Yeah.
You like also, we were also working with Kanye, and I think you were also like, you're producing a lot or working together with artists.
Yeah.
And I think it's crucial to have an understanding or speaking the same language. And when you were thinking about feelings, emotions, and share the same reference, can be boring at some point. But I mean, it's a good starter then.
But yeah, but it's like one of those Venn diagrams. You always have shared references, but everyone's a unique thumbprint. Like no one has the exact same references, so we can all learn from each other.
Yeah,
you know, it's like. I find just as much value in talking to, you know, a 16, 17, 18-year-old about their musical thumbprint as I do a 60-year-old, as I do a 35-year-old. Like, everyone's unique and we can all learn from each other's unique standpoint.
Yeah.
You know, when I meet someone that lived through like the heyday of punk or whatever, I'm really interested to talk to them, because even though it's not my music, like culturally, it's just amazing for me. When I meet someone that grew up going to like Shum and the Hacienda and like the original Summer of Love in Ibiza, I'm like, okay, tell me everything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the same thing is true of the Wag Club in London and, you know, the original scene that spawned like Soul to Soul and Sade and, you know, a lot of the early jazz funk scene and all of that in London, Brit funk and all of that. I'm like, tell me. Same thing when I speak to someone that was there in the Bronx in the late 70s, I want to just sit down with them like a sponge. Same thing when I meet someone that was like, yeah, I went to the World and Danceteria and the Mud Club and, you know, the Garage and all of these places that are like folkloric level, you know, to me, those places are more interesting than going into like prehistoric world or, you know, any other period of time. Like those kind of titans of clubs are more exciting to me than any other period in history. So, you know, it's the same. We're all the same. We all have that kind of fascination, you know.
I mean, that's what I really like about my role in this podcast, because I got the chance to speak to a lot of people telling me about their background and about their story in club culture. For example, I had the chance to talk to Hani Dijon some months ago, and it was like, for me, it was really great, because I, of course, I can read, I can watch videos about the time of New York and Chicago House, but I mean, talking to Hani and then get all the stories and all the emotions, she can really tell me about how she felt, how it was for her to go out and to experience that time. It's a totally, totally different angle to really get these stories, these personal stories.
Well, that's why I'm lucky to do what I do with the radio, because, you know, I did a 2-hour co-host with Frankie Knuckles talking about,
great.
You know, that or even just talking to Theo Parrish for 2 hours about Ron Hardy and, you know, his experience of going to hear Ron Hardy every week, or, you know, the list goes on, like talking to Mad Mike about, you know, all of that music is probably the most influential thing in my life. And so therefore I have a kind of a level of respect for it that is hard to put into words. Like, no matter what happens in my life and where I end up, you know, in what career or whatever I'm doing, I will always look at that with the utmost respect in terms of being the kind of pillars and the foundation for what I'm into. And I'm blessed to work with people that also aren't stuck. You know what I mean? Like, most of the people that I surround myself with and work with are not stuck in ideas of the past. They respect the foundations, but are just as excited about
what's
happening in Chicago now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or what's happening in South London now. Those things are, you know, are of as much cultural significance. Like, living in the present is so important in music and culture. Especially because I find that when I read mainstream journalism about music, people only recognize music after it's happened. You know, like, I grew up in Jungle in London, you know,
it was pretty massive,
and therefore drum and bass. Well, it was massive culturally.
Yeah.
It was massive on the street. It was massive at school. It was massive on pirate radios. But, you know, like, mainstream dance media, press were really snobby about it. They were not, you know, people want to rewrite history the whole time. Same thing with dubstep, same thing with grime, same thing with the UK funky, same thing with, you know, I'm sure there's equivalents of this all over the world. And so people love to kind of like look back and go, oh yeah, of course, you know, da 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 da. Yeah. But actually, nah, the people were not really there for it at the time. Like, we were living it, you know? And so for that reason, it's really important to be the own documenters of your own world.
So when I ask you about your background or the music you feel, the surrounding you're in, then you can tell me. Because, I mean, or maybe when we meet in 10 years, you can tell me even more about your current, like, what were you listening the last 10 years, etc.
That's not, why I'm so lucky to have the radio, man.
Yeah.
You know, this compilation is a...
Deviation
Classics. It feels like a relevant moment to do a time capsule.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily a looking back moment. It is a retrospective moment, but it's like a celebration. It's kind of like a full stop on an era. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because we never did it and we wanted to do it for ages. And you know what's more important than anything is that all of these tunes really stood the test of time.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So, yeah, and it's crazy. And when you look back on it, it was actually quite a pioneering time in music. If you look even like at Martin, Mala, Pearson Sound, Joy Orbison, you know, etc. Like, these people kind of changed music a bit, you know what I mean? Or contributed to it at least. So... But yeah, I mean, I'm. That's why I have the radio, man, is to always be able to reflect what's going on right now and to kind of celebrate the now as well as respecting the past.
For the last question, I got noted what gives you the greatest pleasure, but I can imagine it's what you were saying, like having the opportunity also on Focus on the radio show and getting excited every time.
Yeah, I mean,
about the selection.
The day that I don't have that moment where a tune makes me sit up in my chair and like get really excited or, you know, buzzing about music is the day that I'll hang up my headphones, you know, but I'm lucky that I still have that. And every now, as you can probably hear, I'm sorry, I apologize for being a bit blocked up. I'm like pretty run down. I've got a cold. I don't think it's coronavirus. Don't worry. but I've, you know, we've just come out of a run of doing two pretty big shows and a couple of other things and multitasking basically, where I'm no stranger to kind of like losing myself in the music and doing all-nighters and stuff. So I'm a bit run down at the moment, but my spirits are still super high because I'm continue to be inspired by music. So even when I'm run down and burnt out like this, the thing that keeps me going is music and creativity across the whole spectrum. But I think the thing that makes me happiest is when I hear music that has that special ingredient, that DNA. And people come up to me in the street when I travel, or when I used to travel, and go, oh, this is a Deviation record. This sounds like it's Deviation, you know. Yeah. So we've obviously created some kind of identity with it. And that's the biggest compliment I could have, because records that have that Deviation DNA are still the things that make me excited. And I love the fact that I can't put it into words what makes that. You know what I mean? It's just something that I can hear. So, yeah.
That's a good way to end the conversation. I would love to speak to you for more hours. Maybe we get the chance soon. Thanks, Benji, for giving us your time.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm sorry I'm a bit under the weather, but, you know, it's all good. I hope that we can get back to being in clubs one day soon. That would be cool, wouldn't it?
And then we'll have a meetup in front of the DJ booth.
Yes, it's been a long time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, man. Great to meet you.
That was my conversation with Benji B. I really found myself in several parts of his youth, and I was pretty impressed by his passion and his love for the music creator community that he didn't lose after all that time. I can definitely recommend checking out the compilation we were talking about. That gives you really an impression of a proper night at Deviation. I hope you enjoyed the conversation too. Feel free to leave a review on Apple or text us on Instagram. Gesine and I always appreciate your feedback. I hope to see you very soon. We'll be in touch.
Das war der Telekom Electronic Beats Podcast.
Abonniert den Podcast bei Apple, SoundCloud, Spotify oder Deezer.
Wir sehen uns im Club.
Bis dann.